This is a tape-recorded oral history interview with David Novick. The date is 6/20/88. It's a continuation of our discussion of this morning. The interviewer is Martin Collins. This is tape one, side one. This morning we discuss some of the cost analysis division's contributions to, and in general RAND's contributions to, the initiation of the ICBM program. And I wondered whether you might offer some comment on the connection of Cy Ramo and Dean Wooldridge to this early activity as well, and any possible connections they may have had with RAND at this time.
Cy and Dean worked for Hughes. Hughes at that time was working on the first phase of the Falcon air-to-air missile contract. The contract had been initiated circa 1947 or 8, I don't know, possibly even earlier. By 1951, it was X years behind and X dollars over estimate. The then Chief of Staff of the Air Force, I think it was Vandenberg, got very upset in a review meeting about the fact that they weren't any place and didn't seem to be going any place. As a result of which, he called in the chief of the commanding general of the Air Materiel Command and gave him hell. This was about August 25 or something like that. As a result of this, I don't remember who was the commander then. I remember him physically, but I can't recall his name for the minute. He and another general who had been in charge of the Falcon came to Los Angeles. They demanded a meeting with Mr. Howard Hughes. This was denied. They then said the contract is canceled unless Mr. Hughes appears. This exercise was repeated several times, Mr. Hughes being in Las Vegas and they being here. He asked them to come to Las Vegas. They refused because they said what they wanted to do all involved Inglewood or whatever that place is over there. Finally, Hughes came down from the mountain and they met, and the commander of AMC and his other general demanded the heads of Ramo and Wooldridge and a whole list of the people who had been associated with the Falcon. After 2 or 3 days of hassling, Hughes said they go. And they were fired. The result was that Cy and Dean were unemployed, as well as a whole bunch of people who now are at Litton. Tex Thornton, I forgot. Tex Thornton was one of those who got the sack. And Thornton and Ramo and Wooldridge made a deal. Thornton would go north to Litton in a town up state, and Ramo would go to New York to Solomon Brothers or some other banking group and see if they could get money to set up a organization to tell them how to do these. Thornton went north, he found a deal with Litton. This is the name of a man who started that business. That was so attractive, he immediately forgot about Ramo and Wooldridge and went and found his own bankers. And that's how Litton was born. And he took with him several of the Hughes exiles. Ramo Woolridge didn't do so well on their first couple of shots. And finally, Cy had a bright idea. Here was Thompson Products, a big automotive manufacturer, no nice, shiny defense business. So he went to, I think it was Cleveland, where Thompson Products was headquartered, and offered them a deal. And they said they would take it, but only if they could get 51%. So I said, my partner and I cannot possibly give you control. But when no money was forthcoming, they got control. But more important than that in their history is the fact that when he was, after he went to Cleveland, a fellow by the name of Gardner became assistant secretary of the air for R&D.
You're talking about Trevor Gardner.
Right. Is he still alive?
I honestly don't know.
He'd be an important person for you to see, incidentally. He used to live in Pasadena. Whether, if he's alive, I don't know where he lived. But in any event, Trevor was involved in a new idea called an intercontinental ballistic missile. Bits of work had been done in various places on this idea. A mathematician at Rand, whose name I do not remember, came up with trajectories for intercontinental ballistic missiles in the summer of 1949. I frankly can't place the other scientific work that was being done in this country, other than that was being done at Redstone by the Nazis. But in any event, Gardner and someone in the Air Force had the idea that we should have an intercontinental ballistic missile under, oh, I know, the Navy was the one that had the idea. And they started trying to peddle it in the Pentagon, at which point Gardner heard about it and decided the Air Force should have an ICBM. He therefore went to Caltech and interviewed the head of Caltech and who was also a trustee of Rand,
Lee
DeBridge. And he said, I need help. And Lee said, you've come to me at the right time. He said, I've got a very bright Caltech graduate. Can't remember his name, Cy Ramo, who is currently unemployed. He said, I will give you his telephone number and I suggest you get hold of him immediately. Which Cy did. And Trevor said he would like Cy's help. At the same time, Trevor came to Rand, and a fellow named Kruger, K-R-E-U or U-G, I don't remember, but it's like Kroeger or Kruger, whichever you want. He had a fellow worker at Rand by the name of Krieger, and it was always difficult to keep them straightened out. And they were active in the ICBM idea also, but at Rand. However, they had either been fired or left Rand at about this same time. So when Gardner came to Rand and talked to Frank Kolbaum, saying whom would he suggest for consulting, Frank said Kruger and Krieger. And that's how planning research was born. So we now have Gardner with two brainstormers, brain sources, Ramo Woolridge and Kruger Krieger.
How did you become aware of this larger picture in this?
Because one of the two, both of the generals, the commanding general of AMC and the guy in charge of the Falcon program, were good friends of mine, even though I can't now remember their names. I'll probably think of it at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning. That's one of the things age does to you. And they, between them and Kolbaum and Steve DeBrule, not Steve, Lee DeBridge, Steve DeBrule was a big shot in General Motors. I picked up a piece here and a piece there.
What I wanted to do was, did you have some more comments?
When you get down to the question of the project management, I'm not at all sure that was so much Cy's idea as it was Benny Schreiber's. Benny was a bright guy. Rube Mettler, incidentally, was one of the Hughes exiles, too. They demanded the heads of about 40 people. The fellow who founded a very successful computer business, not the one you'll immediately think of with General Motors, but what the hell was his name? He had been an instructor at NYU and came to see me when he first came out here, because I had been an instructor at NYU once upon a time, too.
We can fill that in later.
But in any event, he's a multimillionaire. He was the dean of the School of Business Administration at the University of Texas for, he may still be for all I know, for quite a few years, and has been a very generous donor to the arts and education. In fact, all these guys have made so much money that it makes me sick to think about it. I sit around here thinking I'm well off, but they are filthy rich.
How is it that the Air Force, after demanding the heads of all these key people at Hughes, turned around and assisted them in forming a corporation which had a tremendous impact on the early missile program?
Hughes came up with the Falcon, which was the original air-to-air missile. No, they didn't. The Naval War Station up here at...
In New Kern?
No, yes, in New Kern. Forgotten the name of the guy there. His missile worked and was cheap and available. That's important for your story. This is a missile developed by civil servants at low cost.
I guess my question was, how is it that the Air Force, after disbanding this key group of people, came to trust them so
expensive? Oh, well, they put it back together again. They didn't abandon the Falcon. You never give up, because this would be embarrassing.
Let's follow up a couple of points from our discussion this morning. I was trying at various points to draw you out about the practices of cost estimating. And after reading over your brief historical account of this development. I wanted to ask a couple of questions, and maybe this was answered in part this morning. The first one is, how do you go about identifying cost elements, as you call them, when you want to do a cost estimation?
That is probably the most critical point in a cost estimate, cost estimator's capability, to identify the cost elements, because without the cost elements, he can't get a cost estimating relationship. In other words, CE and CER are the backbone of the business. And most of these people who are being certified these days wouldn't know a CE if it came up and shook hands with them.
Okay, well, how do you identify a cost element? What's the procedure?
You sweat at it. It's like a lot of things in this world. There's no handy-dandy answer. You try one thing, you try another thing. First, you have to find a parameter.
Okay, why don't we use the, as we were talking about this morning, the example of the ICBM. What was involved?
Well, in the ICBM, the first thing was not a really, truly a cost estimating job. The first thing was the relationship between fuel, throw weight, the warhead, and the weight of the vehicle. Because every time you added a pound of vehicle or a warhead, you added 2 pounds of fuel. And the original warhead would have required a booster about the size of the city of Santa Monica, because you would have needed that much fuel to lift that warhead that distance. When you came up with the hydrogen warhead, you reduced that by 90+%. This immediately reduced the size of the vehicle, the amount of fuel, and it became feasible. Now, in the first concept, when you were going to use all this fuel, the critical cost element was fuel. And the cost estimating relationship was it, that was important was fuel to rocket to warhead.
Can you cite another example where these things were a little more difficult to sort out?
Well, let's take that kind of thing. Electronic devices. At the time I came into the industry, which was 1950, you counted the solder heads in there, because you didn't have chips, you had tubes. Do you understand me?
Yes.
So your tubes required solder joints. And it was a rule of thumb that you multiplied the solder joints by X dollars being another, being an unknown, which you had to sort out somehow. This struck me like an old wives' tale. So I took this device and said, what are the things that are involved in it? And I didn't know. So I brought in an unpaid consultant from Philco. They also were building Falcons. That's how, one of the other reasons I had a lot of inside dough. This guy told me all about what was involved in this thing. And I said, well, why are you counting solder joints? He said, I don't know. Everybody's always done it that way. I said, you have weight, you have volume, You have power output, and you have power input. So the two of us sat down, and we worked for probably 3 or 4 days, throwing figures at each of these parameters. Parameters. Trying to find out what worked if we multiplied the size of that by some dollars, did we come anywhere near what Philco was charging for it? If we took the pounds of it, because another rule of thumb was a dollar a pound. In fact, many people in the aircraft industry still believe it, that every weapon costs a dollar a pound. I'm not joking. Finally, we hit on what turned out to be the plausible tool, power input. In other words, the amount that you're jazzing into this. Of course, that's the volume of my voice, but somewhere you have a meter that shows you how much power you're putting into it, too. I don't know what they're using now, but as of 30 years ago, everybody suddenly started using power input, which was discovered at RAND.
And what were the cost estimating relationships involved once you got power input as the key parameter?
Again, you threw numbers at the power kilowatts or whatever unit you were, megawatts or whatever you were measuring, using as the measure until you found something that made sense. It's art, it's not science.
But it sounds like a process that could be informed by, say, a physicist or an engineer to help you.
They know the answers. They're not willing to sit with you for a day or two bouncing numbers off of something, some other numbers. They will say, this thing looks like it should cost. And then they give you a number. Engineers and scientists all do this. Economists also do this. They are, I would say, just plain lazy. They're not willing to go to all the trouble of learning by rote, as it were. That's why the most important thing you have as a cost estimator is a CER. And when you get one, you polish it, a cost estimating relationship.
Just to be clear, in the case of electronics, the cost element was the
power in.
What was the cost estimating relationship, and what do you mean when you say polish it?
Well, you had to determine the relationship between the power and what this thing was doing. I mean, in a warhead, for example, it would be your guidance. You then try to figure out how much computer you were using, how much of your power was going to your computer, how much of your power is going to your verniers. These are all electronic devices. And you now finally guess, really, what the proportionate cost of each of these bits of power is. In other words, you're distributing what you know, which is the cost of the power. That's the only known in the whole deal.
Okay, and in this case, we're talking about devices that are relatively unproven, things that are concepts,
right,
that have not been developed.
That's right. And the only thing we have is a parameter called power input.
Okay, one fuzzy point for me still is how do you get a cost from your parameter that you hook your whole model on?
You get a cost to apply to the parameter.
Okay.
You say that although this has never been done, for example, in the ICBM case, redstone has been done. The V1, the V2 have been done. Does anybody know what they cost? And you then go to them and try to beat it out of them. If you can't find anything like that, you sit around for days inventing possible costs and beating one another with them until you get one that seems to make sense. Then you explore that and explode it.
And this goes back to what you were saying this morning, that the faith that you can have in these numbers in this kind of case is simply an order of magnitude.
That is good. Right. That's all you're looking for. Because at this point, what you're trying to do is get a basis for comparing this thing with other things that are in the same stage of development or in same stage of research.
You must have come across instances where perhaps you were trying to compare a future possibility, something that needed to be developed, with a proven technology. In other words, make the decision whether to stay with what you have or try to advance the state of the art.
Well, actually, in the B-1 bomber case, you did that. You compared the B-47, the B-52, the B-36, going back to props bombers. What else did we had about five bombers in that comparison, of which the only one that was truly known was the B-36. Because you'd already built like 40 or 50 of them, and you had some knowledge of the early jets.
So what was the upshot of that kind of analysis of attempting to compare an unproven concept with things that had already been developed and were well known?
I don't quite gather what you mean, except that you just took your best estimate of the piece of hardware and of the 10-year system, total system cost. And you then got the operations research types to give you measures of performance. And then you argued about them.
Okay.
And since both sides of the equation were not that well known, there were a lot of slipping and hauling and pushing and shoving.
This may be a difficult question to answer, but then if the uncertainties were so great in these numbers, how were they used in argument for a particular development that might be chosen?
How were they used? You had champions and you had challengers and you had people who didn't like either of them. And they would use these numbers in God knows how many different ways. They would prostitute them, they would pervert them, and they would legitimatize them.
So the decision process was essentially a political one.
Political only in the military sense. Remember, the military was the buyer. And the first decision process was, what were you going to ask for? And this was the truly critical point in the thing.
You mean what the military was going to ask from Congress?
No. Even before that, what you're going to ask for a research contract on. And that's where you get the kind of arguments that Schriever had with LeMay. LeMay always wanted this bomber that was easy to maintain, easy to get aboard, easy to do this, that, and the other thing with. Benny felt that that jeopardized the crew, and he didn't like it. So having lost out on all other bases to LeMay's B-47, he now tried to knock it down with cost. The B-47 won, even though Benny thought he had LeMay several times. Because by the time the final decision was made, LeMay was the self-styled commander-in-chief of the Strategic Air Forces.
Did you have something to add there? Okay. During this time, the aerospace industry within the corporations must have been developing cost estimating procedures as they submitted proposals.
No, the only thing they ever developed was the elementary learning curve of Wright, which he developed when he was with Cornell Aeronautics in Buffalo. Beyond that, they were in the dollar a pound business.
But, well, did you have contact with industry people about the kinds of estimating procedures you were using?
Yep. And for not the kinds I was using, the numbers I was producing. And since these were usually substantially higher than what they were putting to the Air Force, they didn't even regard me as a threat. And it took about 10 years, not quite that long, about 4 years before people like Schriever and General Putt said, we believe Novick, we don't believe you. You're not going to be able to bring this in for that kind of money. And we don't want to be embarrassed. And I always gave them ranges. I never said this will cost them $10 million. I said it will cost between 10 and 30. In a volume of 1,000. Because that's as far as the aerospace industry went. It never had a force concept at all. It never had a weapon system concept. That was me.
But as the Air Force gave credence to your approach to cost.
Not the Air Force. Benny Schriever and Don Putt.
Okay.
There were still plenty of people in the Air Force who wanted my throat.
Did this inspire changes in aerospace industry estimating practices?
Yes. Probably the most important one was when I went to Boeing to get data on the B-47 and B-52. God, what was the, can't remember the name of the guy who was then the president of Boeing, but I was finally ushered into his office.
Are you talking about Claire Egvent?
No, long before that. Remember, we're talking about the 50s. But whoever this guy was, he said, what the hell do you want with this stuff? I said, well, we're doing a system study at RAND. He said, you are? What's that? I said, we're comparing the B-47 with whatever that Glenn Martin bomber was, and the Convair bomber, and some of the other things. He said, what are you doing that for? I said, that's the guts of a systems analysis. He said, what the hell do you need that for? I can tell you what's the best. Get out of here. That was the end of that.
The answer to my question, it didn't inspire any changes.
It did.
Oh, okay.
About 5 or 6 years later, the vice president of research at Boeing, who had a brother here who was then the head of the aircraft division at RAND, the hell was their name? Schreiber. Very much like Schriever, but it's not identical. But in any event, he came down to see me with another couple of guys, and they said, Dave, remember when you gave me your estimate of the 707? I said, yes. He said, remember I told you you were wrong? I said, yes. He said, you weren't. So he took out a little book. He said, don't ever tell anybody I showed you this book. But this is a combination of pricing and learning curve impact. Because they said they would break even at 145 planes. I said, you'll be lucky to break even at 600. By this time, they had made 900, and they had just started to break even. He said, how do you do it? So I had the same conversation I'm had with you a few minutes about parameters and CERs. He said, what can we do to learn this? I said, I want what you have, you want what I have. So I sent a couple of guys to Boeing, and Boeing sent a couple of guys to me. It was that simple. And that's the only point at which there was any true impact. The guys have all retired now at Boeing that were involved in this, but when I was in Huntsville the other day receiving that award that I showed you, the guy who now is in charge at Boeing came up to me and wanted to introduce himself and so forth. And he said, we're still using your methodology. I said, I hope you're changing your CERs. He said, oh yes, we learned that.
One point that you made in the paper was that some of the basic cost elements have changed over time. There are more to be considered, some have dropped off.
Not so much the elements themselves as the relative importance of, let us say, materials, which has become a much bigger piece of the pie, because you're now using mostly composites. And these are very expensive things. They also are harder to work, so they've had an impact on labor costs. The elements are, in that sense, are pretty much the same. That's why I can say the chart hasn't changed, and it's not a chart of accounts. It's a chart of cost elements. But the relative magnitude of each element in the total, the balance has changed markedly. you're using, not everything has gone up equally, I guess is the answer. I'm going to get myself a drink. Can I offer you one?
Sure, just a glass of water, end of tape, one side, one.